Benvenuti ad Alma Lectio, il podcast dell'Università di Bologna dedicato alle Lectio Magistralis tenute da scienziati, intellettuali e personaggi illustri che nel corso degli anni sono stati invitati dall'Università di Bologna a condividere il loro sapere e contribuire alla divulgazione della conoscenza. Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Jacinda Ardern, già prima ministra della Nuova Zelanda tra il 2017 e il 2023. Leadership in the Age of Crisis è il titolo della lezione dottorale tenuta il 20 marzo 2024 in occasione dell'inaugurazione dell'anno accademico 2023-2024 dell'Università di Bologna. Buon ascolto!
Kia ora koutou katoa, nga mihi nui, kia koutou. Buonasera. I begin by greeting you in the same way I would if I were in my home country of Aotearoa, New Zealand, with a word of welcome and gratitude for the opportunity to be with you here today, but spoken in Te Reo Māori, the Indigenous language of my nation. I especially want to acknowledge Rector Malari, the Minister for Universities and Research, Ana Maria Benini. And before I begin, a word too for the many young people in this room. Of the many things that I will say today, I hope you will remember this. For me, you have always been a source of both inspiration and hope. Please never lose your curiosity, expectations, or your optimism against all odds. It is with some surprise that I received the invitation to join you some months ago. After all, I am a former politician from the bottom of the world. What wisdom could I possibly share with an institution that holds the honour of being the oldest university of continuous operation in the world, one that is marking today its 936th academic year? Just for a little perspective, the university I attended in New Zealand was founded in 1964. My parents are older than my alma mater. I accept that age is not always the greatest marker of wisdom, but experience certainly counts for something, and perhaps it is in that vein that I join you today. First, though, an introduction, and I ask for your forgiveness that all of this is in English, and the translation may be slightly out of kilt because I have shortened my speech somewhat than the translated version. I thought I owed it to you all. My name is Jacinda, and up until the beginning of 2023, I was the Prime Minister of New Zealand. I had the privilege of leading this beautiful country of 5 million people for 5 years. And in total, I was a Member of Parliament for 15 years. I became involved in politics when I was roughly 17 years old. I'm the daughter of a policeman and a cafeteria worker. I had no ambition to lead. In fact, I never saw myself as a politician. I was instead what my father would call a tree-hugging lefty, someone who saw issues in the world, unfairness, poverty, inequality, environmental degradation, and believed that politics was the place where solutions could be found. I joined the Labour Party for that reason, and initially changing the world looked more like delivering flyers and knocking on doors. Eventually, I found myself as a researcher in Parliament, an advisor to the Prime Minister's office, and then a Member of Parliament. Eventually, I became leader of my party just 6 weeks out from an election, when I became, much to my surprise, the Prime Minister. I think it was the political equivalent of being a frog in a boiling pot. After more than 15 years in Parliament and 5 years as Prime Minister, you could easily lose your belief in politics as a place for positive change and optimism. But the truth is, I haven't. I doubt I ever will. Instead, what I left believing is just how crucial political leadership is, especially in this, the age of crisis. What exactly do I mean by crisis, though, when literally you could pick from a smorgasbord of dire situations? There is climate change, inequality, massive technological disruption, global conflict, including in Ukraine and the Middle East, the resurgence of nuclear proliferation, and the now very real threat of ongoing pandemics and the havoc they bring. We face the fear of compounding existential threats, but also the anger that these threats are of our own making, and the frustration that any global solutions will either be delivered or derailed by those who choose to do the least. But these problems do not sit in isolation. They exist in an environment where we feel as though we are straining against the seams of endless change and division. With the greatest levels of global connectivity that we have ever had, or it feels like the least unity of voice and of purpose. How then do we address global challenges when we struggle to even agree on the problem? Now, over the course of the last 5 years, I have thought about this question almost endlessly, and I'd like to share a few insights. The first place I come back to is the context in which we have any debate or take on any challenge, the foundations. And that must surely mean taking stock of the current status and well-being of our people. In confronting any challenge, it's hard to start with an open mind and from a place of trust if you feel like you have been left behind, disenfranchised, or are simply struggling to survive. There's a reason when we look at the common features amongst those that have trust issues with government and public institutions and find that they are often in lower socioeconomic brackets. They are living proof of where policy and governments have failed. Our starting point for rebuilding trust and confidence in healthy societies must start with the basics, and in my mind, poverty is one of them. Now, while we don't have all of the answers in our corner of the world, in 2004, the then Labor government introduced a tax credit regime called Working for Families. It was responsible for one of the biggest declines in poverty in New Zealand on record. We built on that approach. We introduced a form of universal child benefit. We substantially lifted benefit levels. We extended paid parental leave, increased childcare subsidies so almost every sole parent qualified, extended free primary health care to children aged 14 and under. We put free lunches into schools in our poorest areas. We increased the minimum wage because in New Zealand we proudly have one. We even made period products universally available and free in all our schools. All of this contributed to sustained drops in child poverty, but coupled alongside policies like making the first year of post-secondary education and apprenticeships fees free, they focused on the overall well-being of our communities too. A politician and Prime Minister in New Zealand from the 1970s named Norman Kirk once said, quote, "There are four things that matter to people. They have to have somewhere to live, they have to have food to eat, they have to have clothing to wear, and they have to have something to hope for." People will always look for solutions to their problems and ways to resolve their needs, but more than that, they'll also look for light, hope, a fulfillment of their own ambition, and they will either find that in political leadership or they will seek out reasons why they have been failed. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, will be able to recall times when they have seen both, and I certainly have. Let me take you once more back to New Zealand. It was the 1990s. For the decade prior, my small nation had gone through some of the most comprehensive economic reforms of any OECD nation in recent history, moving it from a highly regulated economy to one of the most open. The transition was rapid and bumpy. Unemployment reached as high as 10% and 25% for Māori, the indigenous people of New Zealand. Government debt levels were also diagnosed as unsustainable. A significant cut in government spending was announced, which particularly hit those on government support, such as unemployment benefits or those who were solo parents. I was 11 years old when what was known as the mother of all budgets came out. It was so controversial, I even recall seeing a cartoon as a child that depicted the then Minister of Finance standing over a large cauldron of soup with a child begging for more. One commentator at the time stated that the budget formalised the stratification of New Zealand society. Now, through such periods of political complexity, sometimes the lens of a child is telling. My recollection of this time is not of the political machinations, but the impact on people. I remember the children in my school without shoes as certain industries closed. I recall the spread of illnesses that are associated with poverty. I remember a neighbor's son taking his own life. But I also remember what it felt like. The debate around those who were unemployed and on government benefit, or what was otherwise known in New Zealand as the dole, and the increasing use of the phrase dole bludger. Changing immigration policy in the debate that followed, with some political leaders horrifically using terms like Asian invasion. With a help perhaps being aware of it at the time, New Zealand was observing the deployment of one of the most effective tools available to a politician should they choose to amplify and deploy it. And that tool is fear. There may have been many times in our history where fear has been present. The Great Depression, world wars, living through a pandemic. But there is a difference between a genuine fear and politically motivated and generated one. Fear can be used to excuse action or inaction. We see it used to motivate people to do things that usually they wouldn't consider. Fear of migration, diversity, equality, fear that someone is getting resources that you will be deprived of, fear that your way of life is threatened. Fear is one of the quickest and easiest pathways to blame. And why would a politician be enticed to use such a tool? Because by blaming others, you immediately remove the need to find solutions yourself. Ironically, the use of fear as a weapon also has the ability to almost unify people around hyper-partisanship while simultaneously dividing. I feel like this is a useful time to remind you that once again, I am an optimist. I do not believe that people's natural instinct is to reach for fear and blame. In fact, time and time again, I encountered moments that demonstrated to me that for most people, what they seek is not blame, but hope. To be hopeful or optimistic as a leader is to always believe that things should and can be better. To be ambitious. To believe, for instance, as I did, that as a wealthy nation, you should rid yourself of child poverty. Be the best place in the world to be a child. Have equal representation of men and women in leadership or fair pay. But to be ambitious in this way is to set out the destination that you believe you can reach, even if it may take you some time to get there. But to lead in this way is to also lead with your chin. I hope that's not just a saying in New Zealand. It means to take a risk. When you succeed, that victory is often banked and people quickly move on. When you fail, rightly or wrongly, you're criticized for your partially delivered goal and you are incentivized to shrink your target, to lose your ambition, and in doing so, to reduce the public expectation. And so begins the spiral downwards until the public expect nothing, let alone hope. I grappled with this in office, and I don't believe I ever got the balance quite right, but I do know I would rather have been accused of being too ambitious in what I believed we were capable of as a nation than not ambitious at all. And I would rather the public expect us to do everything as leaders than nothing. Healthy democracies. Healthy democracies falter when hope dies. And that's why in a world of significant challenge, politicians need to make a choice to park fear and blame and instead to take the risk of hope and ambition. But in turn, voters have a choice too, to not lose their sense of expectation. And if there is a list of issues where we need to reach for ambition, then it's long-term challenges like those impacting our environment. Now, when I first became Prime Minister in 2017, one of the biggest challenges we faced was climate change. Like every nation, New Zealand has been on a journey. When I worked as an advisor within Parliament in the early 2000s, there was a significant debate on how to deal with agricultural emissions, and for good reason. Almost half of New Zealand's emissions profile comes from agriculture. Not to put too fine a point on it, but the digestion system of cows, and to a lesser degree sheep, produces a lot of gas. And we have plenty of both. Fast forward some 20 years and I found myself in the heart of this same debate, how to deal with our agricultural emissions. It had not gone away, nor had the animosity lessened, but some things had changed. With the need to deliver the Zero Carbon Act, a law designed to get New Zealand to net zero by 2050, we had to address the issue of methane. But this time, we did things differently. From the beginning, we brought in our agricultural community leaders with the determination that the need for change would not be accompanied by blame. I remember one day asking each leader to share with us, amongst those who were gathered, what they wanted New Zealand products to be known for. As each person shared their thoughts, you could see themes emerged. These leaders cared about people's trust and confidence in New Zealand and what we produced. They also knew that if we didn't solve the issues of emissions and food production, consumers would make alternative choices, and it would eventually impact on what was a key export market. We may not have come at the problem from exactly the same angle. Our motivations might have been different, but the foundation was there. And then herein lies the next challenge we face, how to motivate people towards solutions when change is always hard and fraught. It's a massive generalization, but human nature often has us resist change, or at least change that represents uncertainty and a loss of control. The pandemic was without doubt one of the hardest experiences I've faced in the 5 years I had the privilege of being Prime Minister. In New Zealand, there were almost two distinct COVID periods. We adopted an elimination strategy, and the first part of our journey was notable for its unity. There were a number of precursors that made that possible. First, transparency. Right from the start, being open about what we knew and what we didn't. Now, that in itself might seem obvious, but in politics, it's rare. There's often an assumption in leadership that to create a sense of confidence in those who are called upon to lead, we must demonstrate absolute knowledge absolutely. That is to say, when asked a question, any question, we cannot reply under any circumstances with, "I don't know." I hold a strong view that in times of uncertainty, we must be willing to talk about the information and data we have, but also what we don't have. After all, confidence is built as much around trust as it is competency. The public knew that we didn't know everything about COVID. They could see the world was learning in real time as they watched lives being lost. Conceding that we had a knowledge gap wasn't just the truth, it was a critical part of building trust. During COVID, what became more important than having all the answers was having a plan in the absence of them. It's okay to say, "I don't know." It's not okay to say, "I don't know what to do." And so, in the face of imperfect knowledge, we learned together. And the result of that process was the public could see the rationale behind our decisions. So when it came to propose, as we did, something that might have otherwise seen as radical, such as staying home for more than 4 weeks straight, it was not. It was instead the next natural step. We came, quite literally, a team of 5 million. And that team, across the course of 2 years, had on average fewer weeks under what we would call stay-at-home rules, a limited COVID multiple times, saved several thousand lives in our small country, and perhaps most surprising of all, in New Zealand, we lengthened the overall life expectancy for New Zealanders during COVID-19. Building consensus, be it around problem definition or the solutions that might follow, require us as leaders to humble ourselves to what lies in front of us, to be willing to show enough humility that we're able to learn collectively, but enough decisiveness and strength to take decisions in the same imperfect environment. This COVID period in time also gave us an insight into the power of collectivism, or what we might call tribes. I have no doubt we could all point to examples of where building a sense of commonality amongst otherwise disparate groups of people has been effective in guiding people through change, and other occasions where it's done the opposite. During COVID, we saw both. A period of time where New Zealanders were unified around a common cause, and the second phase of the pandemic, where people were fatigued, they craved normality. And the pathway to that normality was, of course, vaccines, but that opened up fractures. People who disagreed with the rollout, others who fell victim to conspiracy. There's no question that disinformation played a role, but what leads someone to be susceptible to disinformation in the first place? Is it in fact the case that the same thing that led to our successful response to COVID is the same thing that led to the fracturing, that coupled with some people's distrust of the state and the media is our constant search as humans for a sense of simplicity and belonging, our almost unwavering pursuit of a tribe? Perhaps. Research has shown that humans are so inclined to form natural tribes that if you put completely unconnected, diverse groups of people into a room and flip a coin for each, those two groups will automatically form a suspicion of one another based on nothing more than heads versus tails. Scientist Robert Sapolsky writes, reminding us that humans organize, whether it's class, race, religion, country, conspiracy, or coin flipping. There has always been a tendency to form us versus other. In recent times, we've seen the acceleration of tribe building heighten, the depth of feeling amongst them grow, and the chasm between them deepen. It isn't just our democracies that feel under threat. It's the health and well-being of our communities. Once again, though, my optimism tells me that if creating a sense of tribalism can be used negatively, it can be used for good too. I saw that firsthand in 2020 in New Zealand. Sapolsky asked the same question. What if we simply change what us means? What if instead of fierce nationalism or self-interest or coalescing around disinformation, we seek to form our tribes based on concepts or solutions to problems? What if we no longer see ourselves based on what we are opposed to, but by what we value, the things we teach our kids, fairness, kindness, empathy, curiosity, and bravery? And perhaps we should start by asking that of our leaders first, that they're fearless in speaking to the challenges we face, but without deploying fear, that they model the values that allow difference to respectfully flourish again, have the empathies to see issues from others' perspectives and seek consensus when they disagree, that they possess the curiosity and humility to keep learning, the bravery to change their mind, and the ambition not to govern but to lead. I was not a perfect leader, not at all. And we certainly navigated some difficult times, but I'm determined that the challenges and lessons from those times aren't relegated to history. I want to share our mistakes so they're not repeated, celebrate our victories so they might be shared, but perhaps most of all, I want to spread hope. After all, we can all be better if that is the leadership we expect. Grazie.
Avete ascoltato Leadership in the Age of Crisis, la lezione dottorale tenuta da Jacinda Ardern il 20 marzo 2024 in occasione dell'inaugurazione dell'anno accademico 2023-2024 dell'Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Malexio.